Hello and welcome to the Fidelity ETF Exchange, powered by Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. This is the 16th episode of the Fidelity ETF Exchange series, and today, co-hosts Etienne Jeanquet-Bouchard and Himesh Patel sit down to recap notable trends and headlines in the Canadian ETF industry for the first quarter of 2021. Some of the key topics being discussed include the continued growth in the multi-asset segment, the rise in ESG ETFs, the style rotation taking place in the factor space, among others. As mentioned, this is number 16 in the ETF Exchange series, so please scroll back to past episodes if you missed them. Recent episodes include a deep dive on fixed income ETFs, a quantitative approach to ETF investing, and a five-part look at factors. Today's podcast was recorded on March 31st, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fidelity ETF Exchange. I'm your host, Etienne Jeanquet-Bouchard, and joining me today is my co-host, Himesh Patel. Himesh, how are you doing?
Great as can be on this fine, rainy day in Toronto.
There you go. That's good. Well, the warm weather's coming up soon. We're already starting to see the spring. We're seeing kind of the light at the end of the tunnel of the winter, which seemed longer than usual due to this COVID-19 environment. But hang on, everyone. We're almost there. For you loyal listeners, you may have noticed we actually took a short break and, you know, took some time off between episodes here. We usually try to keep them bi-weekly, but this has been close to a month now. And I think it's obviously normal as we wrapped up RSP season. It was a very busy time for everyone. So we're glad to be back. And we're going to take this time and I guess take advantage of it given the day we are today. We're March 31st. We're wrapping up the first quarter of the year. So the subject, I guess, for today is we're going to recap some of the notable headlines, some themes, some trends that might have emerged in the first quarter of 2021. As much from a flow standpoint, so what's been popular for investors, for advisors, but also from a performance standpoint. So what's worked, what hasn't worked, what are some of the ways that we can, you know, take advantage of these trends that are emerging. So I think it's going to be a good episode. I think we're going to have, you know, another 20, 25 minutes. This hopefully will be good. Before we go ahead and start and start with the first question, Himesh, I'm just going to take a few minutes to recap what we discussed last time, which was a really great episode in which you and I hosted a very special guest here at Fidelity, Vivian Su, Director of ETFs and Alternatives. The subject was the ins and outs of multi-asset ETFs, which, you know, are also often referred to as balanced ETFs or ETF portfolios. And as many of you know, it's a very hot ETF category these days. In fact, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about this later, but flows are totaling $1.39 billion since the beginning of the year for that class of ETFs, so that type of ETF, and that's as of March 19th. So that's good for close to 20% of all ETF flows. So some of the notable subjects we addressed were the various options available to investors and advisors. What are the advantages of rebalancing? What is the difference between active and passive management in an asset allocation ETF? And many, many more. So if you'd like to go back and you know, listen to that, we have it on our landing page at fidelity.ca. We also have it on any podcast platform under the banner Fidelity Connects. So housekeeping's out of the way. Let's get to it. Himesh, I'll start by asking you, if we think back to our first episode of the year in which we kind of tried to predict or look into a crystal ball and see what trends could emerge in 2021, such as ESG, multi-asset ETFs, we just mentioned, style rotations. Which one do you think has manifested itself already just 3 months into the year?
That's a great question. And I think obviously a very timely question to ask given where we are on March 31st, so to speak, as a report card of what we said about 3 months ago. But I think essentially every single topic or trend that we thought about has kind of played out in the market. So
are you saying we have a crystal ball? Because I mean, we're not going to share, obviously, but
let's take a moment for a pat on the back, maybe. But, you know, we did predict some of these things that happened. And one of the biggest ones was the rise in the multi-asset ETFs, like you just talked about. You know, we launched it in January, but the industry has kind of moved that way in terms of where the flows are going. And we're seeing about, like you said, $1.5 billion of flows into this category. And, you know, it's a great option for investors with not a lot of assets to invest, who want that diversification. And that's really why this asset class is driving so much of the flows year to date. I think another one of the big trends was ESG that we talked about. And that has clearly taken the forefront of the ETF industry, the investing industry in general, with ETFs being about $2 billion of flows into ESG ETFs this year. And I don't think that trend is going to go away anytime soon either, which is something we took a real deep dive into in our first episode this year, mm-hmm. as well as a couple of ones that you guys did last year. But I think one of the other biggest trends that we noticed, and you talked about this a lot, was the style rotation. Mm-hmm. So what have we seen from styles and regional rotation perspective?
Absolutely. And we're right now, we're talking really about, you know, money flows, or what are people looking to add to, or what, you know, where's the money flowing? We'll get more into performance and specifics later, but I think you hit the nail on the head with, you know, pretty much every single one of these. I mean, I feel like there's every week you're going to hear about a new ESG ETF being launched and them being relatively popular. And there's, I'm sure that in the near future, we're going to see a combination of two of those trends, you know, with balanced ESG ETFs, or, you know, like where you're combining an ESG themed fixed income mandate with an ESG themed equity mandate, or any other type of, you know, solution in the thematic environment, social or governance space. But definitely from a flow standpoint, those have been strong. Another one, I guess, that we can point to, I think south of the border, obviously, and it's becoming more and more popular here in Canada, is the rise of, because it's been around for a while, but the continued adoption of thematic ETFs. Mm-hmm. Like for example, one of the most popular, you know, down in the US, ARK, being a very higher type growth mandates, technology, various segments of technology. I mean, just recently we had a launch of a space ETF. Yep. Which includes, you know, names like John Deere, surprisingly, but anyways, I'm deviating from the point here, but those have become very popular, whether that's online betting, social sentiment. So for those of you that know the people at Barstool Sports, for example, launching their own ETF, we've entered in a realm where it seems like almost anything is possible in the ETF space since the beginning of the year. But, you know, how does that translate going forward? It's going to be very tough to tell how long these can be popular. Was it just more a function of what did well last year and the market being a little bit, or the retail investors stepping in and playing a much larger role?
Maybe it's all the stimmy checks.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the argument for there, that's what it is, right? Is that these are sexier ETFs, right? They sound cool. They seem to add some value, obviously, from a performance standpoint. And I'm sure they could also from a portfolio construction standpoint. But I'm deviating from the point a little bit, and I want to go back to some of the trends that we saw impact performance and where assets are currently, because these are kind of things that are emerging and assets are being gathered here and there. You mentioned a style rotation, a rotation from, you know, maybe moving from US money being invested in the US to anything ex-US, whether that's Canada, emerging markets, international. But there's really one I need to talk about for some reason, because I get asked a lot by advisors is, you know, what's happening in the fixed income space? And fixed income markets have been more volatile recently than they have been in a long time, just because we've had a rally, I guess, in bond yields. So I guess is my question is kind of, what is your take on this? How's this impacted the ETF landscape? Obviously, the majority of fixed income assets in the ETF space are held in passively managed fixed income ETFs. So what's been the impact on these products?
It's been very negative, to say the least. And, you know, we talked about this in our first episode of this year as well, but I think it was pretty much common knowledge that given where we sort of ended off last year in terms of the yield curve and where yields were, there was no place for yields to go really but up. And obviously nobody could have predicted the really sharp increase, which we saw pretty much over a 30-day period, rising about 1% on the yield curve on the 10-year, the U.S. 10-year yield. But it was pretty much common knowledge across the industry that yields were going up at some point in 2021. And so for those investors that position themselves with more actively managed fixed income ETFs and funds did do a little bit better than, like you said, the passive ETFs, because they had the ability to take lower duration risk or, you know, go into other sectors of the market that weren't as tied to the interest rates. And do better when rates rise, like high yield bonds and floating rate bonds. So for anybody that was invested in the passive Canadian bond indices, ETFs, or US aggregate bond ETFs, were really, really hurt just given the fact that duration on these ETFs were around 7 to 8 years. And so that was essentially a 7 to 8% negative price return, given that yield spiked about 1%.
It's a tough thing to digest, right? As an investor, and you look at your fixed income portion of your book, and obviously plays a massive role in equity corrections. Longer, you know, generally speaking, the long duration trade has been the way to go. You could even say back to 30 years, if you look on an aggregate perspective, yields have been generally trending down, and this rapid rise has really kind of exposed us to how we position ourselves relative to the yield curve, and obviously relative to the asset classes that you mentioned, because there's obviously some portions of the fixed income market that are much less sensitive to moves in interest rates. Obviously, those that are more tied to credit credit spreads or not spreads, excuse me, but credit risk that are more tied to the business activity that's going on, as well as just overall financial conditions. And we really saw those asset classes shine, but unfortunately, there's just not that many assets there. So we tend to own really the kind of boring fixed income, which is a little bit more sensitive. Would you say that there's been any rotation from, and we're going back to a flow standpoint, because performance, we've obviously addressed that right now, but have you seen or spoken to advisors that were looking to change the way that they're positioned based on what's moved in the short term? So maybe reducing their overall duration, maybe allocating a bit more to those other asset classes, or is it kind of just more, you know, this is, you know, a sell-off in fixed income markets, we'll hold and we'll see where we are come the end of the year?
I think it's kind of a mixed story. It depends on the investor profile, where there's, you know, their risk and tolerance in terms of time horizons as well. And obviously at the stage of where they are in their investing careers. So I think for those investors that have had that fixed income exposure and longer duration bonds and getting that nice yield over the last couple of years as well, have started to move into other asset classes like dividend paying equities, because they need that yield in their retirement and they need that income to be generated from their portfolio, which in today's environment, you can get a nice solid dividend yield of about 3 to 4%. Relative to fixed income, which is only offering you 1.5%. And, you know, I think one of the bigger points of that is for those investors that maybe were 60-40 portfolio investors, 60 equity, 40 fixed income, they've now had the chance to take on a little bit more risk because of the rise in yields and where we've seen sort of equity positioning going back over the last 5 to 7 years. Predominantly in the growth area and momentum area, has now sort of repriced and rotated. So I know you have a lot of insight into what's happening here, and curious to see what you're thinking on how that rise in interest rates has impacted these equities on growth and momentum.
Well, and you kind of led me there also with the dividend story, because those mandates, while they had, you know, any dividend focused ETF or the majority of dividend stocks last year had a relatively weak year in terms of performance. It was a tough, very tough environment. You know, obviously with COVID-19 lockdowns, a lot of companies were forced to shut their doors, protect their balance sheets, which eventually leads to, you know, keeping more cash flows in-house. So you're not distributing them to shareholders. But there was a big catalyst in November with the announcement of the COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer and BioNTech, which kind of started what, you know, however you want to call it, but this kind of great early cycle rotation where the typical asset classes that tend to do well when we're in a recovering economic phase of the market have really responded and have showed up this year. And that also speaks to overweighting equities versus fixed income, because as we recover from an economic standpoint, that tends to lead to higher inflation, which eventually will push yields up. But from a rotation standpoint, there's really three or four that you could point to that have manifested themselves. One of them is US versus ex-US, large cap versus small cap, and then growth to value. So you've seen those, it's starting to take place. We're obviously nowhere near historical norms from either a valuation or performance standpoint. But how has that impacted conversations you've had with advisors, in the sense that this is taking place? It might be here for a little while, at least until we get more clarity on it, on inflation globally. How do you see this playing out? Let's start with, for example, with the first one, which I think is the most talked about, is growth to value. How's that manifested itself? What are you seeing?
So we're definitely seeing a lot of interest and a lot of questions surrounding that. I think flows tell a really good story in terms of what is actually transpiring and how people are positioning. If you look at, so the Canadian market, the Canadian ETF market, value ETFs have taken in about $400 million of flows year to date. And if you look down to the US, you add a couple zeros to that, it's about $6 billion of flows into value-oriented ETFs.
Wow.
And so I think, you know, for most investors, you and me both put together as well, it's kind of a hard pill to swallow to think about value as being the outperformer right now, as well as what the outlook might be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been in such a great environment for growth and momentum that it's kind of hard to leave that trade and switch over and rotate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as time goes on, you know, we might continue to see this outperformance. Like you said, who knows what the future will tell us, but I think it makes, from an overall portfolio perspective, prudent sense to at least get some of that exposure to value.
Mm-hmm. And that's another great point, is diversification, is that after you've had a very strong, say, 3 to 5 year outperformance of a certain style, or, you know, in a certain case, asset class, it tends at one point you revert to the mean, or I hope you would revert to the mean in a certain way. And it doesn't necessarily mean that your growth stocks will not work anymore. From a relative standpoint, though, they might not do as well as other things which have been left out of the market. And, you know, even from a sector standpoint, we talked about it earlier before, you know, this podcast, you look at some of the sectors that are doing well year to date from a performance standpoint: energy, financials, real estate. I mean, that's literally the opposite of what worked last year, and that's worked over the past 4 years. You know, ever since 2016, when we had somewhat of a little reflation trade following, you know, the collapse in commodity prices at the end of 2015, there really hasn't been much love for those asset classes. And obviously it was warranted, because, you know, that it wasn't working, and we were entering that really low rates, low growth, which very much emphasizes the need for companies that are compounding at a higher rate. But that low correlation asset class, that, or not asset class, but style that value provides, versus what we've, I guess, unknowingly owned more of, which is growth. Because if growth was 10%, you know, US large cap growth was 10% of your portfolio 3 years ago, It definitely wasn't 10%, unless you rebalance, you know, annually or quarterly. It's definitely worth more than that. So I think we left ourselves a little bit less hedged to a rotation than before, unless obviously you're holding a very diversified strategy, which in which case, you know, you're happy both ways. But I think that's one that really sticks out and will continue to be a hot topic. It's always been, but now we are definitely getting more questions on how to play that and how to incorporate it into portfolios.
And I would say it actually increased given the rise in rates, just because now when you're looking at a growth stock at a valuation rate of 1.5% versus a valuation rate of 1%, that stock looks now a little bit more expensive than it should have in the past. And that's giving more rise to more flows even moving towards value, because these stocks are still trading at 12, 13 times earnings. You can still get really good companies, and they've shown that they can perform over the last number of months. We've seen that value as an overall factor has outperformed growth by about 10% globally. So the dispersion is definitely there. But going back to your earlier point about sectors and sort of the cyclical rotation, that brings out, that dovetails into a nice little story about the US versus ex-US trade. Mm-hmm. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it tends to fall into one of those things as well, where when you have a peak in markets, whatever, and I think it really comes back to what you were saying in valuations. Valuations kind of like duration. The longer duration you have, or the highest valuation you have on a stock or on a fund, the more sensitive you will be to move in interest rates. You were talking about it with a growth stock. Well, if you're valuing this company heavily based on future income or future cash flows, your discount rate increases and you're basically left with less intrinsic value now. And if you take that from a larger geographic perspective, well, US markets were a lot more expensive than international markets. So it comes back to kind of that value that, you know, I don't want to say value to growth, because you're buying an entire market, so you have, you know, a little bit of everything in there. But from an absolute perspective, I mean, it was a cheaper market. And that's the first, I think that's the first domino to fall. And then if you think of, you know, emerging markets, for example, tend to benefit from a weaker US dollar. We actually saw the US dollar weaken, you know, in the first quarter of the year, obviously now changing a little bit, but, you know, overall was weaker. And obviously from a sector standpoint, you find a lot more of the, I guess, lesser liked sectors. So relative to the US, if you look at the MSCI IFI index, for example, which is international developed markets, there's more basic materials, there's more industrials, mm-hmm. there's also more energy slightly, and there's also more financials. So you have more cyclicality in embedded into your index from naturally. And it would be the same if we look from a factor standpoint. Our value factor that we have at Fidelity internationally versus the US, I mean, you're overweighting sectors that are already larger weights. So, you know, even in the US, whether you like tech or not, and you want it to be part of your framework, it's still such a large portion of that index that you can't get much lower than 15, 20%.
Exactly.
So those are some points. If there's anything to add, please go ahead. Because I know you've been doing lots of client meetings regarding this subject, because there is an appetite for reducing US exposure and going elsewhere.
Yeah, there's definitely an appetite. We'll see exactly how that transpires to the remainder of this year. But I think, you know, this begs the question. So we've identified some of these trends earlier this year, and they've clearly played out. What's your sort of outlook for the remainder of this year? Do you still think that value, cyclicals, international?
We were one for one on our calls at the beginning of the year. Now we got to do this again. Chance to mess it up. No, I'm kidding. But
you have to be critical of your report card.
Exactly. keep ourselves honest here. That's a good question. I honestly don't see. I think this value rotation, maybe not to the speed or the extent that we've seen so far, I think that continues to play out at least until, say, the end of the year, unless we have obviously notable change. And once again, we do not have a crystal ball, but there's just hasn't been necessarily any catalyst to the other side where, I mean, yes, inflation hasn't manifested itself, but you're getting lots of indicators saying that inflation will likely be higher in 6 to 12 months from now. How much of the market is that? How much of that has the market priced in? I mean, that's obviously impossible to tell, but given it's forward looking. But I really feel that the catalyst in place for that value rotation remains in place. I was looking at the other day at the manufacturing PMI in the US and splitting it up between all the different categories. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with that, I guess report, it's a survey among manufacturers on their business activity. So as much as orders they're taking in, what's their inventory levels at, what are the prices they pay for their goods that they produce. And I looked at two categories that really struck me. And the first one was the prices paid. So how much it costs to produce goods. And we found ourselves in an environment where we reduced supply substantially last year because everybody could not go to work for health reasons. And you know, obviously, so supply was constrained. We left demand off, but now demand is creeping back up. So you've seen the price of a lot of commodities rise rapidly, which is eventually going to make its way to the price of goods. And so basically,
to the consumer, essentially.
Well, exactly. And to that point, the prices paid, I guess, report or scorecard for on average manufacturers, and this is automakers, chemicals, you know, every single category, it's at the highest that it's been since 2008. So the prices we're paying for goods. Now, if you look at the other factor, if the customer inventory, so the businesses that are buying these goods and then selling them off to customers, their inventories are at the lowest level they've been in more than 15 years. So if you pair that with highest prices paid with the lowest inventories, you're going to have forced buying at the highest price. And it's the same thing with the housing market. So I think there's maybe a little bit of room for this inflation narrative, at least for the narrative to continue to go on. But obviously how much of that is priced in, very difficult to tell. Anyways, I'm rambling, but I really do think value is definitely not, that rotation is not over. And from a valuation perspective, we're still bottom quartile from a historical perspective. So that's one definitely I expect. I think we'll continue at least for somewhat time.
And how would you position yourselves in this sort of environment, given where rates are, your inflation expectations, the outlook on cyclicals?
I mean, to stay diversified. I mean, like, once again, I might have a little bit of conviction on this trade, but things can change very rapidly. You could have the central bank stepping in and, you know, forcing the hand, keeping short-term rates low, and that's going to, you know, eventually calm the yield curve steepening that's happening. And you might just go back to growth outperforming. So I think the words of wisdom, and I think this may be boring to say without being very strongly having conviction on one end or the other, just pairing strategies that seem to have low correlation to each other. So mm-hmm. if you have a lot of, you own a growth manager on the active side, well, maybe pair it with some, you know, some value, a value ETF, or flip side, you know, you own value managers, add some quality or momentum, or, you know, a passive indice that is more growth tilted, like the NASDAQ, for example, just keeping a diversified basket. Same thing for fixed income. Don't be, you know, I wouldn't be trying to play the duration game right now. If you want, like, calling to go long or calling to go short, I think in both situations, it could be more detrimental than something else. So I'd probably recommend going with an active manager there that's very nimble and can go into other asset classes. What about you? I've been rambling for like 5-6 minutes here. I need some Himesh comments.
No, I definitely agree. And that was exactly what I was trying to get to is, you know, there's no pound the table trade at the moment right now where if you buy into this asset class or this category right now, you're guaranteed to get some upside. I think the name of the game right now is making those pair trades, ensuring that your portfolios are diversified across factors, across sectors, across geographies. And that's actually where we're seeing a lot of our success as an industry, where clients are now realizing, yeah, maybe I have a little bit too much growth, too much US exposure. And that's exactly what's happening with flows, where we're seeing lots of money going into value, international ETFs, small cap ETFs, even to some degree. So I would say, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think the name of the game for the remainder of this year should be try to keep your volatility as low as possible, because we know we're in for a pretty volatile ride for the rest of this year.
It's going to be a fun ride though. And we're going to enjoy along the way, and we're going to bring you more content about. And we're going to keep doing these podcasts and try to, you know, share our insights of what we hear, what we see. So I think we're going to, you know, close it off at that. Himesh, we're up to close to 30 minutes now. You know, I really liked this episode. I think it was fun. We got to talk about some stuff that was very timely as well. And once again, I think Himesh had mentioned it last episode. Feel free to reach out to us. You can find us on LinkedIn. Give us your feedback. Tell us what you want to hear about, and we'll make sure to incorporate it in our future episodes.
Tell us if we're right or wrong on our calls too.
Keep us honest. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Himesh. Thank you everyone for listening in, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity ETF Exchange, powered by Fidelity Connects. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, please leave a 5-star rating or review. Thanks again. See you next time.